Good morning.
Good morning.
I think most of you know who I am, but welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If this is one of your first times here, there will be a time later on in the service when you will be invited to introduce yourselves if you so desire. And we always encourage you to come for more than one service because our services can be very different. Sometimes they're done by people outside our congregation. Sometimes they're done by lay leaders within the congregation. Sometimes they're done by me, Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Prairie strives to be and generally succeeds in being a welcoming congregation, open-minded and open-hearted. We welcome you no matter where you are on this journey of life. I invite you to the first after church forum. Well, it might not be your first ever, but it's the first on my watch, to be held this morning after the service. So we'll gather in here. I'm going to try to do this the last Sunday of every month. The opening words are the same words you just heard from a Chinese proverb. Where there is light in the soul, there will be beauty in the person. Where there is beauty in the person, there will be harmony in the home. Where there is harmony in the home, there will be honor in the nation. And where there is honor in the nation, there will be peace in the world. For centuries, people have told stories, celebrated life, and approached the ultimate while gathered around a fire. Today, we light this chalice so that the hearth fire of our hearts may be rekindled, so our stories may be retold, and we might celebrate life anew, and we might approach what is of ultimate value. I'm going to skip most of the reading, but it's fascinating, I assure you. And I have gotten so bogged down in this that I didn't even manage to get over here quite on time, did I, Barb? And I've been asked to submit a paper about this subject to a journal, so we'll see. But at any rate, I'll just read one part. I don't know how many of you are familiar with who Gail Collins is. She's an editor at the New York Times. I believe she's still an editor there. But her books are astounding. This is, I think, her most recent one. The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present is the subtitle. The title is When Everything Changed. I was going to read you just a few snippets about the 50s and what the culture and what that meant for women. And there's a wonderful segment on Howdy Doody that I was going to read to you. And then a little bit about airline stewardesses. Some of you of a certain age may remember the days when airline stewardesses, of course, were all female. There were also things I didn't know. For example, there was a flight from, I want to say, New York to D.C. or Boston to New York or to D.C. that was men only, a regularly scheduled flight. And among other things, the stewardesses were expected to, there were very few female passengers even on other flights unless a family happened to be traveling together. The men, of course, got extra large steaks, drinks, and cigars, and the stewardesses were expected to light the cigars. Then suddenly, everything changed, Collins writes. The cherished convictions about women and what they could do were smashed in the lifetime of many of the women living today. This book was published in 2009, I believe. The transformation was imperfect and incomplete, but it was still astonishing. And this started, things don't just suddenly start, but this really became apparent in 1960. A generation that was born into a world where women were decreed to have too many household chores to permit them to serve on juries. I did not know that. And where a spokesman for NASA would say, quote, "Any talk of an American spacewoman makes me sick to my stomach," would come of age in a society where female astronauts and judges were routine. Then suddenly everything changed. The cherished convictions about women and what they could do were smashed in the lifetime of many of the women living today, Gail Collins writes. Well, I'll say everything changed. I have been a beneficiary of much of that change, as several of you in this room have also been. For a female, a great time to be alive, at least in this country. Whether or not this is still true remains to be seen. I do think that we are living in troubled, scary times, and that many of the gains women have made could be in danger. There are many reasons for this, not just the most obvious one, the election of a flaming misogynist to be president of the United States. There's always the conundrum that occurs when those who come after the revolutionaries begin to take for granted the progress that has been made, the opportunities that have been created. So there is that. And there is the small matter of whether or not the goals of the feminist movement that occurred in the 60s and 70s, sometimes called the second feminist movement, the second wave, whether they've been met. Is this job finished? Well, let me just ask you a few things. Do we have an equal rights amendment? No, we do not. Do we still need shelters for battered and abused women? Yes, we do. Do women make the same amount of money as men do in comparable positions? No, we do not. Are there equal numbers of men and women in the Senate and in the House of Representatives?
At least there are women.
Well, this is true, but we have a very long way to go. And last but certainly not least, do men do 50% of the household chores? Now, I know that there are major exceptions. I know my son does. We better. But we have a... What? I kid. We have a long way to go. I said this in the newsletter, last month's newsletter, and you all read your newsletters, remember? This is as I keep saying. We put a lot of work into that. There are paper copies in the lobby if you don't like to read it online. We have a long way still to go to defeat sexism, to rid this nation of misogyny. And even that statement is hilarious, I think. Sexism is just as prevalent and worrisome in our country as racism is. Now, uttering those words can be problematic, maybe sometimes a bit dangerous, because it's sort of like saying in Israel, or maybe even in this country, that you're pro-Palestinian, that you think the Palestinians should have rights. There's a leap then made by a lot of hearers of those words that you're anti-Semite. No, I'm not anti-Semite if I say I support Palestinian rights. It's the same thing with saying that sexism is as insidious and threatening in this country as racism is, if not more so, because we don't address it. Am I a feminist? Oh, yes. And I was particularly so in the 60s and 70s. And where would Paula's sister have been in the story today had her mother not stood up for Judy? And then, of course, Judy got to the point where she certainly could stand up for herself. And where, what would my life have been like? I'd still be sitting around waiting for a model of ministry who wasn't male to magically appear somewhere other than in the Catholic Church, of course. Some definitions of feminism. First, from a book review in the Athenaeum publication of April 27th, 1895. A woman who has in her the capacity of fighting her way back to independence. Another one from Rebecca West. Some of you will know that name. In 1913, she wrote this: "I myself have never been able to find out precisely what feminism is. I only know that people call me a feminist whenever I express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat." From Susan Faludi in 1991, "The point of feminism is to win women a wider range of experience so that they are not forced to choose between public and private happiness." In 2009, this from Gail Collins: "Feminist simply means someone who supports equal rights and opportunities for women." I would slightly amend that to say for all women. In 1960, when I was in high school, Collins wrote — she didn't write this in 1960, she wrote this a few years ago — "It seemed that once women had gotten the right to vote, they never got anything else. How were women discriminated against in the 60s? Well, I've already said, in many ways, including lower salaries. My biggest regret was the inferior sports facilities. I might have thought about professional tennis, but Billie Jean King didn't come along quite in time for me. And then there was my mother in high school in the 1930s, who still, until the day she died, ranted and raved about the fact that women's basketball could only be played to the half court line because they were too weak. My mother, at barely 5 foot tall, was a very good basketball player. Here's something I did not know. In 1960, Social Security benefits were computed differently on women's wages than on men's. To me, one of the most distressing things in this time period was the fact that almost everyone took these discriminatory policies for granted. That's just the way it is. If you really want to push my buttons, just use that phrase. No one considered the possibility of major changes. Well, that's a sweeping generalization. Obviously, several people did, or we wouldn't have the changes that we do now. But that fact that so many people took it for granted, gives me both hope and takes me into despair, because the hope, of course, is that there are those who don't take things like that for granted. The despair is that there are way too many people who do take things like that for granted. There were some major exceptions, as I said. President Kennedy once asked Katharine Graham, publisher of Washington Post, why Adlai Stevenson, whom Collins describes as balding and chubby, was regarded as so attractive by his many female friends. Adlai Stevenson, I hope most of you have heard of. He ran for president against Eisenhower in 52. He never once campaigned in a primary, though. He was a very highly regarded United States ambassador to the United Nations. Kennedy responded to Graham, Graham said, "Stevenson actually listened with interest to what women had to say." Kennedy responded to Graham, "Well, I don't say you're wrong, but I'm not sure I can go to those lengths." When I told my high school guidance counselor that I wanted to enroll in the School of International Service — my male guidance counselor — I wanted to enroll in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C., he laughed, then did his best to steer me to a different school and certainly to a different major. My options were supposed to be airline stewardess, though even if I had been interested in that career, I couldn't meet the height requirement. I really couldn't. Teacher, nurse, secretary. Women went to college to get our MRS. Oddly, the guidance counselor turned out to be correct about my going to American University. I only lasted a semester, but not for the reasons he had voiced. It was too big for me, too overwhelming. So I transferred to a small college, Edinburgh State College in Northwest Pennsylvania, which I'll bet no one in this room ever heard of. We'll talk. To be closer to my boyfriend.
Is there also Edinburgh in England, too?
Yes, Scotland. Scotland. Spelled differently. But the important thing here is that I transferred to, well, transferred for a number of reasons, but mainly to be closer to my boyfriend. I look back on my life now and I'm astonished at how many of my major life decisions were driven by male opinions. At Edinburgh, we females were not permitted to go to downtown Edinburgh, which is about this big, in pants. That doesn't mean that we didn't go downtown in pants. We did, after all, own trench coats, and we knew how to roll up our pant legs. And those were also the days when the college's dean of women would police the lounges in the dorms to make sure we weren't doing anything that we shouldn't be doing with our boyfriends, which of course only made us more determined to do those things with our boyfriends. We've come a long way, baby, maybe. So I married the guy, though we did not quite live happily ever after. We were okay for quite a while, and he is the father of my children, and we are on good terms now. Well, except politically. He won't go there. After we married, he got a good job in another small town in northwest Pennsylvania, and we were both athletic folks. We loved sports, so we joined a couples volleyball team, where men got one serve and the women got two. I refused to take two. Not to worry, I got them on the first one every time. I had a good spin on that ball. Well, I would not take two unless everybody would take two, or one. You would not believe the backlash. You would not believe the teasing my poor husband had to put up with. Well, I guess we know who wears the pants in your family, was the milder version of it. Now when I look back on that, I think we were both surprised by the taunting and what I realize now was bullying. My husband wasn't upset with me. He thought I was making a good point. Where was this ugliness coming from? It was also in this period of my life that I discovered Betty Friedan, Simone de Beauvoir, Gloria Steinem, and so many, many others. I devoured Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, reread it. I'm still proud of the fact that I am a charter subscriber to Ms. Magazine. Now, there's not time this morning to go into this, but at the same time that everything was changing so rapidly, really, for women, things were also changing for blacks, though not so rapidly, because the civil rights movement and the women's movement were intertwined. Unfortunately, there was often a sense that people had to choose which movement they were going to throw their support behind. And in hindsight, I think that was a mistake. We don't have to isolate the oppressions and only work on one at a time. But I don't think we had any kind of a grasp of that then. Who reads Yes Magazine? Which I highly recommend, especially in these days when things are gloomy. Yes always has some very positive things. They don't just say, use nice, sweet words. They give you examples. In the summer, last summer, 2016 issue, only comes out four times a year, there's a wonderful article written by a black woman who talks about fighting oppressions and how the isms all intertwine and we have to go after them all at once. And she uses a word that I was not familiar with, intersectionality, that I'm learning a lot about because I went off on that tangent too in my research. Which I'm going to really simplify this because it's not necessarily a simple concept, but essentially I believe it's saying just that we need to recognize all of the isms at the same time. You may be black, you may be white, you may be male, female, you may be transitioning into something else. What difference does that make? If you're oppressed, you're oppressed. In 1964, only two states in this country included women in their fair compensation laws, Hawaii and Wisconsin. Two states in 1964. Back when Wisconsin was, well, Wisconsin. The one that many of us knew and loved. As that federal rights, Civil Rights Act that started out in 64 under Lyndon Johnson, as it was making its way through Congress, most of us in this room, I hope, kind of know the broad outlines of that story. But you might not be familiar with this part of the story. Howard Smith, a congressman, a representative, not a senator, from Virginia, was then chair of the Rules Committee in the House, which meant he had a lot of power. He happened to be on that show called Meet the Press, which some of you may have heard of. It's a talking heads show, so maybe one of the first. One day in 1964, and he was asked in all seriousness a question by a woman named Mae Craig, who was one of a very small number of women reporters who weren't confined solely to the women's pages. Her question: would Smith consider adding women to the minority groups who would be protected from discrimination by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act? Now, you need to remember that Title VII was the most controversial part of the Civil Rights Act. Obviously, there are a lot of people who did not want to protect minority groups, particularly blacks, who did not want to, whites, of course, did not want to be protected. So Howard Smith, did not think that Mae Craig could possibly be serious. So he tossed off a flippant answer. Well, maybe I would. I am always strong for women, you know. He was kidding. As part of his joke, he actually stood up in the House of Representatives and proposed an amendment that would add women to those who were to be protected from discrimination in the Civil Rights Act. He never thought any of this would pass. There's not enough time to go into detail about why he did this. I think he was a bit elderly. And as I said, he just knew the bill wouldn't pass. As Gail Collins puts it, Howard Smith's decision to play games with the Civil Rights Act was an extraordinary example of unintended consequences. I have to pause for just a moment in this story to give a nod to another Smith, Margaret Chase Smith, the only female in Congress for a very long time. She served in Congress from 1949 until 1973. And she played a very important part in making sure that that amendment stayed in Title VII and thus in the Civil Rights Act. Now, the jokes that men made, and many women too, I'm still appalled that many women voted for Trump, so I can't put all this on men, but there were so many really bad jokes about, oh, now men could be stewardesses and secretaries and Playboy bunnies. There are all sorts of jokes about men becoming Playboy bunnies. When this issue got to the House of Representatives, there's an organization in here that, so how do you enforce something? Right, it passes, how do you enforce Title VII and the whole Civil Rights Act? Well, one of the ways to do this was the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. When this issue, when they opened their offices, before they even unpacked their typewriters, the first plaintiffs came in, the people with the first complaints, stewardesses. Who would have thought? They had to maintain this certain weight, of course. They were subject to spot inspections. They couldn't be married. When this issue got to the House Labor Committee, and you would not believe the remarks, you can go back and read these in the records of Congress. Finally, a representative named Martha Griffiths, who was for a very long time the only woman in the House, but she's an incredibly supportive husband. She let them go on and on with all these actually raunchy, crude remarks about the female stewardesses. And finally, she stood up when everybody got quiet and she looked at this committee and she said, "What are you running, an airline or a whorehouse?" She got everybody's attention. Some of you will remember Lorena weeks. And the suit she brought against Southern Bell, she asked for a promotion. I'm still in the mid-60s, just for another moment here. And she'd been working there for a long time at Southern Bell in Georgia, in Atlanta, and she had not ever had a promotion or a raise. So she finally got up the nerve to do this and took a lot of heat from the other, from the male workers, and even from, unfortunately, from her own husband. Well, she was told that there was a Georgia law that said women could not lift anything over 30 pounds, which the promotion would, the new position would have entailed. Well, her typewriter weighed 35 pounds. And she was expected to take it out of something over here and put it on her desk every day and put it back into this little storage area. So after this decision came down, the next day she went to work and she didn't touch her typewriter and she started writing everything out. And of course her boss says, "Ah, what are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I can't lift that. That's 35 pounds. It's 5 pounds over the limit." Eventually she won. In the mid-70s, a different husband of mine, they're all engineers, just so you know. And I do like men. I had such a delightful, wonderful mother-in-law. But she was so immersed in the pre-1960 culture and the mindset. So one evening we're playing, I don't even remember, I think it was Scrabble. It might have been Bridge, but I think it was Scrabble. Me and Mike, my then husband, and dear Marion, and Mike left the room. I was winning, way winning. And Mike left the room for a moment, and Marion leaned over to me and whispered, "You are going to let him win, aren't you?" Should have knocked me off my chair. This was a brilliant woman with a master's degree. I thought she was kidding, but she wasn't. And no, I did not let him win. And to his credit, Mike was appalled as I was by her question. Mid-80s, I'm working in the mechanical engineering department here at the University of Wisconsin. The chair of the department asked me to make coffee. Now, I love coffee, but you don't want me making coffee unless it's in a tiny pot. I said no. And you know, to his credit, he did a double take and he said, "What do you mean?" And I said essentially what I just said to you. I said, I don't make coffee. I don't think it's in my job description, but I make a terrible pot of coffee. And he, I don't know, that was a moment for John. He started kind of spreading it around, even among the male professors. A brief tale from the 2000s. This name might be more familiar to you than Lorena Weeks. Lucy Ledbetter and Goodyear Tire. And again, we have a woman who had worked there at a company, big company, for a very, very long time. Made a fair amount of money for a woman, worked the night shift and worked a lot of overtime. So it's time for her to retire. And she starts filling out various forms and she realizes that she was making like, not even 70% of what a man doing it, the job, was making. And it was worse in her earlier years. So she filed a complaint with Goodyear Tire. And they said, "Well, too bad. There's this very fine print law that says you have to make such complaints within 180 days. And she was past that time frame. She lost initially, but then she appealed. And the argument was, who would ever know that until they were retiring or doing something? You know, you just wouldn't, usually don't go around. Plus, who tells you what they're making? It's hard to compare. She won the Supreme Court at the Supreme Court level, and Obama signed her the bill in 08. This stuff is, we're in the 2000s now. I'm hiking at the Grand Canyon a couple of years ago, and it's a really steep part, and by myself, I get, you know, stop to take a drink of water or something, and these three men my age came past me, stopped, looked at me, and said, oh, you've lost your group. Oh, where's your group? Now, this infuriated me.
friends of mine have said, they were just being kind. No, they weren't. You weren't there. You didn't hear the tone of their voice. And plus, I said to them, if I were a man by myself, would you have said this? No, they finally admitted. We're in the 2000s here. One of my more recent trips to the Grand Canyon, I go into a restaurant on the rim, I sit down. I know there's this man right behind me. I mean, I'm not 20, okay? So there's this guy right behind me who didn't wait for the hostess to seat him. And I sit down, he sits down across from me at a table for two and says, you don't mind if I sit with you, do you? Yes, I do. Moved to the next table facing me and just kept on me and on about, well, you know, I was the mayor of Boulder City. Do I care? We haven't changed our mindsets much. Nora Ephron said that the major achievement of the women's movement in the 1970s was the Dutch treat. But Betty Friedan reminded us in, 2004, 2005, not long before she died, there's a lot of silly talk that the women's movement is dead. Well, it's not dead. It's alive in society. I think that we have to remember that a lot of progress has been made, and there are a lot of signs that younger women are getting it. They're not taking the gains for granted so much anymore. And there was that, as I said, wonderful article in Yes Magazine last summer. So I just want to repeat one more time, if I haven't already, I've certainly implied this. Being a feminist does not mean that I'm anti-men by any means. I am a feminist and a masculinist, which of course makes me a humanist. Feminists want what all people want: recognition, acceptance, value. You know, there's that old cry from men and from a lot of women too. What do women want? I think we could say the same thing about men. What do men want? We want what everyone wants: to be recognized as valuable creatures, to be seen, to be cherished, but not suffocated. So I've borrowed from a song that our hymnal calls As We Come Marching, Marching. Some of you will know it as Bread and Roses. I have borrowed their theme, as it says in the poem and the song, as we come marching, marching, we battle too for men. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. Some of you will know that the Bread and Roses, that this goes back to 1917, I think, 1911, somewhere in there. It was a labor dispute in a textile mill. The rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler, ten that toil while one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories. Bread and roses, bread and roses. We want both, because we want whole, meaningful lives in both the private and the public sectors. And we want that for all people. Men, too, of course, no matter one's gender. And then, to paraphrase Margaret Fuller, a new manifesto will be at hand, and a new hour will arrive. Turn to page 575 in the back. And you'll get a little more Fuller. I think a lot of you know who Margaret Fuller is. She lived in the middle of the 1800s, and she was a Unitarian, and she was probably responsible for a great many of Emerson's thoughts and words, even though he co-opted them. She was just so far ahead of her time. Talk about taking a lot of heat and a lot of flack. So I will read the... why don't you start and read the regular type, and I'll read the italics.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
When men and women may regard one another as brother and sister, able both to appreciate and to prophesy to one another.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
What women What woman needs is not as a woman to act or rule, but as a nature to grow, as an intelligence to discern, as a soul to live freely and unimpeded, to unfold such powers as were given her. Man does not have his fair share either. His energies are repressed and distorted by the interposition of artificial obstacles.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new power is come.
We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man.
Were this done, we believe in the divine energy that would create nature to a degree unknown in the history of former ages.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour has come. I'm going to do something that may get me fired. I'm skipping the congregational response because we don't have time. But you will note that I am, that's one reason I want to offer the after church forums. That doesn't mean I'm never going to do a congregational response again. I almost always do them. But if you want to gather afterwards and share some of your stories, that would be great. And I know there aren't any other meetings today. Pretty sure there aren't any other meetings today. Last time I looked at the calendar, there weren't. Closing words were written by Emma Goldman. Someday, men and women will rise. They will reach the mountain peak. They will meet big and strong and free, ready to receive, to partake, and to bask in the golden days of love. What fancy, what imagination, what poetic genius can foresee the potentialities of such a force in the life of men and women. Go in peace. Oh, drink coffee. Greet your neighbor.